This is the TriDot Podcast. TriDot uses your training data and genetic profile combined with predictive analytics and artificial intelligence to optimize your training, giving you better results in less time with fewer injuries. Our podcast is here to educate, inspire, and entertain. We'll talk all things triathlon with expert coaches and special guests. Join the conversation and let's improve together.
Welcome to the show, everybody. It is episode 175. Every 25 episodes, we dedicate the show to asking a panel of our coaches questions from you, the athletes in our audience. I've got the big four with us today. Number one, TriDot Director of Coaching, John Mayfield. TriDot Pool School Director, Joanna Namey. Pro Triathlete and TriDot Coach, Elizabeth James. And TriDot Coach and Biomechanics Expert, Jeff Rains. The timing here is fun because I feel like all five of us were just doing this for the best of 2022 episode that aired at the end of last year. Are y'all ready to hear what the people want to know this go around?
Ready.
Ready.
Yep.
I am so ready to hear what they want to know and know that they know that we want to say what we know so that they know. Woo! Say that five times fast.
I'm Andrew, the Average Triathlete, voice of the people and captain of the middle of the pack. As always, we'll roll through our warm-up question, settle in for our main set conversation asking your questions, and then wind things down with our cool-down. Quick reminder for everybody, TriDot is currently running the 2023 edition of our annual research project that we call the Preseason Project. We are looking for non-TriDot athletes who want to jump into the research project this year. Qualifying athletes will get 2 free months of TriDot training. It's literally 2 months of the best quality training available in exchange for TriDot getting to analyze the training data that comes in from those sessions. I started training with TriDot during the 2018 preseason project and immediately took a liking to the structured training schedule and saw huge improvements in my swim, bike, and run. My 70.3 PR before TriDot was a 5:57. And after training with TriDot, that PR is now a 5:02. For those of you doing the math, that is a 55-minute improvement for me since continuing with TriDot after coming on board for the preseason project. If you already train with TriDot, now is the best time to invite your friends to participate in the preseason project. And if you're a podcast listener and you have never given our training a try, head to TriDot.com/PSP. Join the preseason research project and enjoy 2 free months of TriDot training. That's TriDot.com/PSP. That URL will be in the description for today's show.
Time to warm up. Let's get moving.
Today's warm-up question is also an audience question, and goodness gracious, it's a very specific one. I'm not fully sure what we're going to learn here. This is either going to be real eye-opening or real just matter of fact, but it came in from the audience and I am willing to give it a go. Dara Harms asked this and she said, hey, this could be a nutrition type warm-up question. Tell us all of the foods that you ate yesterday. So at the point that we're recording this podcast, I think part of the fun here is no context. You know, we can't all five explain everything we ate and why or when we ate it. So no context allowed. Just hit us with your quick list. And once it's out there, your January 9th in food is out there forever to be judged by the TriDot Podcast audience. So, Jeff Rains, for you, this was all chips and queso, right?
Pretty much, man. That's 90% of my diet. Mic drop done. I did have some pita and hummus and salsa, but no queso. But yesterday, eggs, English muffin for breakfast. I had that pita hummus wrap for lunch. I did have some of my daughter's cereal. It was Fruit Loops.
Nice.
Dinner, we had leftovers, barbecue chicken, black beans, salad rice. Sarah baked some homemade chocolate chip cookies as well. Yeah.
All right. Well done. A nice peek at the dinner table for the Rains family. Elizabeth, what is this list for you?
Okay. Well, I've been logging all my nutrition in Chronometer, so I'm just pulling that up and I can read it off. So here
nice.
We go. We've got whole wheat toast with strawberry jam, pineapple chunks, Yucan energy powder, the orange flavor, my favorite, and then a Yucan edge gel, also the orange flavor on that too. Then you can energy plus protein as my recovery drink.
Detecting a pattern here.
Yeah, exactly. Little you can add here. Then toast with natural peanut butter, banana, you can energy with you can hydrate, more you can stuff, and lifetime pre-workout. Then tart cherry juice with you can aminos, chicken and wild rice and vegetable soup with some crackers and some collagen mixed into that. Then a superhero muffin. That's like my favorite go-to snack, Shalane Flanagan's cookbook for the recipe. And then chicken, broccoli, sweet potato, and a protein shake.
Shalane Flanagan. Nice little shout out to Shalane on the podcast. What a running.
Yeah. I know you said no context, but I think
that's
works,
just where like, it came recipes. From. That's not like why you ate it or why you chose it or where you put it in your day. John Mayfield, what all did you eat? Did you have as many UCAN products as Elizabeth did?
I didn't have near as much stuff as she did. I have two things. I had to like actually think pretty hard. It's like, you know, this was almost 24 hours ago. Lunch was some broccoli cheese soup, homemade. My wife made it. It was quite delicious. And then I was kind of by myself for dinner last night. So just had some leftover chicken and green beans. Nothing too exciting.
What a simple man.
What about breakfast?
He skipped it. That's the implication, right?
No breakfast?
I had like a shake for breakfast. And lots and lots of coffee.
Joanna Namy, what on earth did you eat yesterday?
This sounds so odd that I can't stop giggling. After Elizabeth's dissertation on nutrition, I ate the same thing almost every day, but oatmeal, chia seeds, egg whites, turkey sandwich, always on GF, leftover piece of lobster and beets for a snack, granola bar, steak and asparagus, holding my nose, getting the steak down because I hate meat. The end.
So far, my biggest insight into y'all's eating habits is the fact that Joanna considers leftover lobster and beets paired together as a snack. that just kind of quietly works its way in there that I just casually had a piece of lobster and some beets as an afternoon snack.
I missed my lobster snack yesterday. Got busy and didn't get to have my lobster mid-afternoon.
For me, I had a Kodiak microwavable breakfast muffin for breakfast. Lunch was a Starkist salmon packet, hickory barbecue flavored. I had a biscuit and honey, a cosmic crisp apple, some baby carrots, and two York peppermint patties at lunchtime. Afternoon snack was a little square of Gouda cheese with some sourdough crackers. And for dinner, we hit up Chick-fil-A. It was a Chick-fil-A night. For us, I got a grilled chicken sandwich, a kale crunch side salad, and a lemonade to polish it off. So that was my day in food. One of you asked this question, so hopefully this was insightful for you. We at least learned that Joanna has lobster as a snack in the afternoons, if nothing else. We're going to throw this question out to you, our audience, and find out, what did you eat yesterday? This podcast is coming out on a Monday, so it'll be a Sunday that you're reporting all the things that you ate. Can't wait to hear or see or read if there's anything wild on your list.
On to the main set. Going in 3, 2, 1.
We've spoken to sports scientist Andy Blow during several episodes of the podcast to help you nail your hydration and fueling strategy for training and racing. The big takeaway from those episodes is that there simply isn't a one-size-fits-all approach to race nutrition, and that's why Andy and the team at Precision Fuel and Hydration have developed the Fuel Planner. Head over to precisionfuelandhydration.com to use the Fuel Planner, and you'll get your free personalized fuel and hydration strategy. The plan provides guidelines for how much carbohydrate, sodium, and fluid you should be aiming to consume so that you know your numbers for your next race. You can then hit those numbers by using the Precision Fuel and Hydration product range, which is designed to make it easier for you to keep track of your intake during racing, since the carbohydrate and sodium content per serving is smack bang on the front of the packaging. As a TriDot listener, you can use the code TRI10 to get 10% off your first order of Precision Fuel and Hydration electrolytes and fueling products. It always makes for a great show to simply be able to ask our coaches your questions. I always procure these questions from the I Am TriDot Facebook group, from my email, Facebook messages, and our podcast voicemail. system. If you have a question you would like to have answered on a future episode like this, you can always message me. You can go to trydot.com/podcast and click on leave us voicemail, or you can send me an email, andrew.harley@predictive.fit. Let's get into the questions. Athlete question number one here on episode 175. This comes from Tom Cassano. He says, I plan on doing Ironman Lake Placid in 2024. I was wondering how much TriDot programming adjusts or changes for a race with that much elevation. Does it actually adjust my training, or does someone have to train outside on hills themselves just to get in that specific training? A similar question came in from Boris Cortez. He asked for tips to train for a hilly race living in a pancake flat city. So maybe TriDot coach Jeff Rains, talk to us about training for hills with TriDot.
Yeah, great questions, guys. And Tom, good luck. Lake Placid, what an iconic kind of bucket list race. 2024, the good thing is you've got plenty of time to combat those hills, prepare and train on those hills. But yeah, let's give a little insight there. First, I've got to refer to our RaceX, our race execution site. It knows you, it knows your thresholds, it knows so many awesome metrics about yourself, but it also knows the exact course that you're going to be racing, right? And so TriDot doesn't train you largely, Tom, for 112 miles only. It trains you, so to speak, for the time that you're going to spend on your exact race in those exact conditions on that exact course. So it knows the elevation gain of Lake Placid, but it's not just, okay, is it this X number of feet of gain in the whole race? It knows how that elevation is distributed along the course. Is it one giant mountain hill, or is it 50 little hills, right? And so it knows the time that you're going to spend in each discipline on that race day, and it knows the elevation of the city above sea level. It knows a historic and kind of a predicted weather aspect. And as you get closer, it goes to actual weather. And so all of these things work together in knowing the time that you're going to spend in each discipline on that specific race day. And then you will train largely at percentages of that time and work up the plan to be ready for it in that regard. As far as tips to train for a hilly race, man, in your training, your zone 4 and zone 5, they are largely hills. The human body knows effort, not necessarily that you're on a hill. But I do have to say that, there is a technical aspect of knowing how to ride on hills, how to body position, how to gear, right? Getting out of the saddle. So you need to know how to ride on hills. You need to get out there and ride on the hills. But your day-to-day training, the zone 4, the zone 5, that there's a different training response kind of goal in each of those. Now, last thing I will say is what I like to do is know the weekend route that I'm going to ride that weekend. And is there a lot of straightaway flats? Are there hills in that? And I like to break up my zone 4 segments on different parts, right? We can kind of soft pedal up a hill, right? And we'll be in zone 4 or zone 5 watts. The hill is creating that resistance for us. But if we're on a flat straightaway, we have to create that zone 4, that zone 5 effort, right? And so
you got to put the power down.
Yeah. And so, talking it over with your coach or being very intentional with the routes that you're going to ride. Maybe for the first, part of your season, you want to do half of the zone 4 on a flat where you're creating it, and the other half of zone 4, do it on a hill so you can learn those technical aspects. And then as you get closer to race day, do more and more of that on actual hills. But hopefully that helped a little bit. There's a big, it depends portion there, but from a higher level, hopefully that helped out, guys.
Is it creepy if I say that I know where Boris lives? Like,
yes.
Well, not like exact address, but like DFW,
yes, it is.
Area. Still creepy. Okay.
It's not creepy. We here at TriDot are that invested in our athletes' lives that we know where you live.
There we go. We'll reframe it in that way. But anyway, I was just thinking, like, Boris, we should chat. I've got some routes for you. I mean, you're in the DFW area. I've got like a 100-mile route from McKinney that has like 4,000 feet of elevation.
Do you
gain.
Now?
So,
wow.
So we've got an option here. As I was training for Chattanooga and, Des Moines last year, I was like, okay, where can I find some hills? So I've got some hills for you.
Question number two. This comes from Trident Ambassador Shannon Rogers. He's always good for a solid question on these episodes. We've asked a few Shannon Rogers questions before. Shannon is asking this. If you have time for only one around the normal three sports training, so we have to spend time training the swim, bike, and run. If you have time to add something, should you add something like yoga, or would it be better to add something like strength work? Elizabeth, what do you think here? I know you do a lot of extra in your training. What would you recommend for your athletes if they have time to add one thing?
I would definitely say strength over going to a yoga class, but the focus of your strength session is going to depend on like how well you're moving. And this is one of the things that I truly believe Dr. Leeper just does an outstanding job of
overviewing in some of the
podcast episodes. Yes, he does. And so, I mean, as he outlines, we need to be able to move properly first. And then once we can move, then we can load that particular pattern. So your strength session may be more mobility work than necessarily lifting heavy weights if you haven't addressed that foundation yet. So you need mobility, then stability, then strength. I mean, all of that is in the form of strength work. And so I would say that would still come before, you know, a particular yoga class. But your strength session may look more like mobility work if that's where your need is at that time.
Outstanding. Wonderful input there, Elizabeth. That makes sense to me. And BJ, certainly on a number of episodes has outlined the importance of, mobility and stability and strength, all as, separate inputs. And so, yeah, your body's got to move the way it needs to move in terms of mobility for you to stay healthy in the sport. So, of the three, that's a great kind of, summation there. You know, you need mobility first, then you need stability, and then you need strength. Question three, this comes from Trident Ambassador Sarah Barr. Sarah was at Ambassador Camp in St. George, had a good time getting to know her in person. She asks, how often should you take a mental break from training? We hear about the pros doing it at the end of the season, and I've heard about adding a short break mid-season as well, but Trident takes us from a race to a couple weeks of recovery, then right back into the development phase. Is it on us to take a break when we feel like we need it and just skip some workouts that are prescribed in our plan? Do we need a break? John Mayfield, what do you think?
So I think this is a great idea. It is going to be very individualized based on each person's season, what their training looks like, what their history in the sport. Really, it's going to depend on a whole lot of things as to what that athlete needs, how frequently they need this, how long the duration of that break is. But really, you know, it's, as you mentioned, it can be a mental break, which means it doesn't have to be a physical break. So, there's going to be seasons of recovery built into the training phase, especially after those, larger races, those times of higher volume. There's going to be a period of time built in that is going to provide, for recovery to the body, to rest up, relax, recover from all that work that is done over the last several months. As well as the strain of that race. But you know, I think, again, it's, you mentioned that mental break, which I think is a great idea. This is something I really encourage athletes to do. And oftentimes it's hard to get them to do it. I think vacation time is a fantastic opportunity to pair this. Oftentimes I'll get questions from athletes like, hey, I'm going on my family vacation. How can I best integrate my training into my family vacation? And a lot of times it's like, you just shouldn't. Enjoy your time there. One of my favorite things to do while on vacation is just go for an unstructured run wherever I'm on vacation. Just kind of set out and try not to get lost or, stick to the safe parts of town. But it's a great way just to kind of do some sightseeing. Maybe it's getting up before the family and doing something like that. If you have the opportunity to do something like a cool open water swim, but, you know, something for like a swim session, you know, I think a lot of times the effort it's going to take to go find a pool, take time away from vacation and go get in a swim session is not really going to be that high value. You're probably better off just enjoying time with your family and taking things in. So you know, that's for me what those mental breaks look like. There's going to be seasons of ebb and flow with work and that sort of thing, where things get busy. So just use them as they come and use them as needed. So I would say keep them as short as possible. Because you know, detraining is a real thing, and we want to keep making progress. We want to make build upon past successes. But you know, as often as you need that, take it. You know, we don't want to push too far and get into burnout and that sort of thing. We want this to be enjoyable and fun and productive. I'm a big advocate of those mental breaks. And, you know, I think for me, they really look like unstructured training. It's not necessarily a complete break, from training, but really do the sessions that you want to do. That's kind of my guide for the athletes I work with. If you wake up and you want to do the session, then do it. If you don't feel like doing it, don't, you know, that's kind of different than the day-to-day in season. If you don't feel like doing it, do it anyway, unless there's a reason not to. But in these seasons we've identified as a mental break, if you don't want to do the session, then don't do it. Or if you want to change the session, you know, if you want to go a little shorter, if you want to go a little lower intensity, you know, that's a good time to do those and use those as kind of momentum or even consistency to take you into those regular season, regular phases once you're back to really nail the sessions as prescribed.
Yeah. And we had a podcast episode just a few episodes back. I know Elizabeth, you were on the episode where we were talking about, coming back to training from a break. And one of the things Elizabeth specifically talked about on that episode was just outlining, how long does it take for us to lose fitness on a break? And it's not 1 week. I mean, if you have a week off cause you're on family vacation and you're just taking a mental break for that week or two, you're not losing any of the fitness gains that you picked up over the last year or so of training. And so I think that's the fear for some people is, oh, I don't want to lose the progress that I had. You're not going to lose that progress that quickly. It takes a pretty extended break to begin to start to see a deterioration in certain forms of fitness. We're all type A, and if there's a session on the calendar, we want to do it. And just like Coach John just said, if you want to take a week of a mental break or a week of vacation or the holidays comes around, and you feel like you kind of need that little reset, take that little reset. And John, I love that approach that you just gave there. All good stuff. Moving on to question four, this comes from Kurt Yanish, Ironman finisher Kurt Yanish. He was on our podcast episode talking about Ironman Texas, where he got his Ironman done. So Kurt is a podcast veteran here at the Tryout Podcast. He is asking about open water swims at elevation. He said, every time I do an open water swim at elevations over 5,000 feet, I panic. It is like my CO2 sensor thinks I am drowning. Is there some way to train my body and mind to overcome that sense of panic? Now, I know Kurt, like I said, is an Ironman finisher, got the job done in Ironman, Texas. He lives in the state of Wyoming, where I'm not sure if he's at elevation there or not, but anytime he swims at elevation over 5,000 feet, feels that sense of panic. Coach Joe, as one of our swim experts here at Tridot, as our director of pool school, what would you say to Kurt on kind of that sense of panic setting in swimming at elevation?
Well, that is a great question from Kurt, and it's probably one of the most common questions we get as coaches. And there are a number of techniques that I've talked about in previous podcasts when dealing with anxiety. Anxiety is not, solely for beginner athletes. It affects very experienced Ironman athletes across the board, and we often don't know when it's going to sneak up on us. It's scary. But there. I've spent a lot of time drafting some tips for my own athletes to deal with anxiety as it creeps up, and I can talk a little bit about those. But you could go on and on. But in general. Andrew, you'll love it because I'm going to refer back to the box breathing. But the box breathing is a technique that is a common technique to lower the heart rate and to calm the nerves. And I have a procedure for my athletes to start that about 15 minutes before they even get in the water to line up. But again, that has to be practiced. It is like any other swim or run drill. We can't say, okay, here's my open water technique. This is what I'm going to do. I'm going to start box breathing, but it has to be practiced so you know what you are doing. In addition, I talk about a go-to plan, and this involves another type of practice in the water, whether you're in the pool or open water. What are you going to do if you panic? If you start feeling anxious feelings, are you going to turn on your back, do a little bit of backstroke? Are you going to take some deep breaths and doing that, or breaststroke? you know, what makes you feel comfortable? What sets you at ease? And I ask my athletes to practice that in the pool as well as in the open water. But for Kurt, I would overall say, you know, the hard reality of this is to prevent anxiety, we need exposure. We need exposure to the situation that causes us anxious feelings. For him, he's talking about being at a high elevation, being in open water. He feels short of breath. When that happens, when any of us feel short of breath, it makes our heart rate skyrocket. It makes us anxious. So I have to tell Kurt, you got to get in that water more. You got to get in, not once or twice every 6 months. I'm talking about twice a week in that environment, in that specific environment or those conditions that cause you anxiety. And then practice what your go-to is. Okay, now I feel short of breath. What am I going to do? Maybe I'm going to slow down my pace a little bit. Slow down my pace. That's going to let my heart rate settle a bit. It's going to let my anxious nerves go away. So, you know, that's one way. And lastly, one technique that we can use to distract ourselves is a plan for mental focus when we're doing open water. So right now, Kurt may be focusing on, okay, I'm entering the water and now I'm starting to feel anxious because I'm short of breath. I can't catch my breath. Where if we have a laid out plan of, you know, four areas we're going to focus on as far as stroke form, I'm going to think about my body position in the water. I'm going to think about a strong kick. I'm going to think about a powerful pull or hand entry, and spend about 5 minutes at a time going through all of those different parts of our swim form. We're actually tricking our mind. We're actually taking away the focus from I can't breathe to I'm going to slow down just a little bit and focus on these different aspects of my stroke. And that's going to allow me to remain calm and to actually swim faster and more smoother in the water. So that would be my advice for Kurt. But again, I could go on and on for days on ways that we can deal with anxiety, both in open water and in racing.
Yeah, so at the time this episode is being released, it is late January. I know in late February, that's the time frame we've targeted to launch the Tridot Triathlon show on YouTube. And so Coach Joe Woloth, I have a segment where you demonstrate your box breathing kind of protocol on the video. Can't wait for that already. This is the kind of stuff that that we're going to be doing on the show, is just giving you guys kind of the visual side of how to be a triathlete. And Kurt, I do know on my list of topics to hit on the Tridot podcast, I do want to do an episode on elevation and how elevation affects our training, affects our racing. Tridot does in your pacing when it's prescribing your workouts. It does account for elevation in your kind of prescribed zones and paces, which is great. But to your point, Kurt, that this isn't a pacing thing. It's just a comfort. Is my body doing something at a certain elevation thing? So we will have an episode that comes out later this year that really addresses that a little more specifically with somebody who has expertise in scientific study of elevation and its effect on physiology. So be on the lookout for that. Kurt, question number five. This comes from Craig Jimenez, enthusiastic Tridot ambassador. He gave us a voicemail recording to actually ask his question on the podcast in his voice. I always love it when athletes do this. It just kind of gives us a break from the five of us talking. So here is Craig asking his question.
Greetings, Tridot family. Second year ambassador Craig Jimenez out of beautiful Winters, California, with a two-part question. As a 57-year-old athlete, I oftentimes suffer from insomnia. I'll wake up in the middle of the night to use the restroom, and for some reason, my brain will decide that's a really good time to start thinking about things. And then I go down the rabbit hole of not being able to sleep because my brain is suddenly engaged. First question is, do you have any tricks for turning the brain off and getting back to sleep? And the second question is, do you have a line in the sand that you draw when you're working with a sleep deficit as far as skipping or postponing training sessions? My concern is that doing a vigorous training session on 4, maybe 5 hours sleep may have negative results instead of positive results. Although I will admit having some pretty decent training sessions on some abbreviated sleep. Keep up the good work, folks, and I look forward to the podcast weekly.
All right, great question there from Craig. Thanks so much for throwing it out there. I also, Craig, am somebody that just, I don't sleep well. I've always been that way from being a kid all the way up until now. My Kindle stays on my nightstand, and if I find myself just kind of laying there, my wife is sound asleep, it's midnight, and I'm just kind of laying there, I'll crack open the Kindle and read for a while, and some nights that goes on for a while, some nights it doesn't. But anyway, I'm curious to hear our coach's answer here as well, because, yeah, a night of not sleeping great can certainly throw off the way you feel heading into your training sessions. Coach Elizabeth, what would you say here to folks like Craig, folks like myself, folks that just aren't all that great at sleeping soundly through the night?
Yeah, this is a good one for me to answer, because I am right there with you guys. So
nice,
Craig, I feel for you. Yeah, sorry you're dealing with those sleepless nights. Like I said, I'm right there with you, and it is incredibly challenging. What I've usually found is that if it's one poor night of sleep, you'll likely be able to push to the full intensity yet the next day and kind of train as prescribed. But where I personally need to start backing off, and I've seen other athletes kind of in that same situation, is where it's more than one sleepless night in a row. And at this point, going into a training session, I understand that my body isn't at its full capabilities. I mean, if you're run down, you have a greater risk of injury. Your body's ability to recover and repair itself is already lowered. Being sleep deprived also kind of raises cortisol levels, makes your immune system more vulnerable to any viruses around you. So we do want to take this seriously, and we want to make sure that, you know, by training, we're not actually doing ourselves and our body a disservice. So when coming off a few rough nights with a sleep deficit, using perceived effort has been very helpful for me. I know that, you know, the pace or the specific wattage might not be in the same range, but I can at least gauge the effort that I'm giving. I know those external factors, such as the lack of sleep, is influencing the workout. And I just go in knowing that I'm going to allow myself a little bit more grace with that. The other thing to really be aware and be mindful of is how that effort is in relationship to where your heart rate or other metrics usually fall. So if you're supposed to be doing an easy ride on the bike and it feels just super hard and your heart rate is sky high from the beginning of the session, using that hour to rest instead of bike and rest, even if it's not sleeping, even if you're not able to take a nap, just rest, you know, sit there with your eyes closed, read a book. That can be a very productive use of that time as well, because what we don't want to do is just continue pushing so that we really dig ourselves into a bigger hole. Keep this in mind. Recovery is training. And so taking care of your body on those days where you've had a couple sleepless nights and you just feel run down, that's going to allow for better training performance when you are able to be rested. The last thing that I'll say is really just kind of enlist the help of a medical professional. I mean, this is something that, you know, I sat in the doctor's office and talked with my primary care physician about and said, all right, here's the deal. Like, I need to train. I want to train. There are so many great health benefits of me training, but my lack of sleep is keeping me from doing this. And so, you know, talking with her about, you know, some suggestions that she had just to improve the nights of sleep that I was able to get. You know, they might have some great suggestions that allow you to get a more consistent night of good sleep that'll allow for good training going forward as well.
I'm going to sound like a broken record here, but this is something that we plan on talking about on a full-length episode sometime this year. Dr. BJ Leeper and I have already been kind of looking around the marketplace to identify the right subject area expert on sleep and how it affects triathletes to come on the show. So he and I are excited to target that with another expert later this year. And while I'm saying this, we had several athletes ask questions about either doing aquabike or aquathon, which are versions of triathlon where you either swim and run or swim and bike. So it's two disciplines instead of three. How does tri-dot training handle that? How does it account for the differences in those races? That is another full-length episode we're going to do. And with so many athletes asking about it, I've accelerated that one. We're going to release that episode sometime in the springtime as opposed to later this year. So for all of my Aqua Bikers and Aqua Thoners. Be on the lookout for that full length episode. I'm holding your questions until that. It's funny. We're 175 episodes into our triathlon podcasting journey, and there's still so many topics we want to talk about on the podcast. Elevation, sleep, aqua bike races are still on the list. Question six for today's podcast episode. This comes from Carrie Craig, saying, I do a lot of extra sessions. I'm retired and love to train. So I train more for enjoyment than for performance outcomes. Extra sessions show up as NA on the calendar. But do they influence my training plan optimization and workouts ahead on the schedule? As an example, I just participated in the Rafa Festive 500 Challenge, which was way in excess of the 3.5 hours of cycling on my Tridot schedule for the week. Did that affect what Tridot put on my schedule for the following week? Coach John Mayfield, what does Tridot do with extra sessions that we put into the week that then show up on our training calendar?
So just a note that NA is actually relating to the TrainX score. So if a session is done outside of what is prescribed, there's really nothing to score. So TrainX provides feedback as to how well a prescribed session was executed. So again, when there's nothing prescribed, there's nothing to score. So that's why those show with that NA there. A session is largely evaluated all the same. So it's not necessarily contingent upon that session being a prescribed session. It receives the data, analyzes the data, and adjusts training going forward accordingly. So whether that training, the session was part of the training or not, it can influence those future sessions. So what the analytics are doing is looking at the data within that file to see how the body is responding to training, what the body's doing, things like NTS, accumulated NTS, those types of things, and then refining training going forward based on that. So yeah, if you have a session that is in far excess of what was prescribed, chances are you could see a reduction in volume, a reduction in intensity. It's going to depend on what exactly was done within that session and what you had coming up. But all that is going to be taken into consideration just to ensure that you are training at a safe volume, safe intensity, safe training load.
All right. Question seven. This comes from Kath D'Souza. Kath wants to know, I was sick over Christmas with a sinus and respiratory tract infection. So some advice on how to come back after illness, especially with Tridot, would be great. Now, my quick answer here would be go back and listen to the Tridot podcast episode about how to return from training from a break. We do talk about illness a little bit on that episode. That was a fairly recent episode, so you don't have to look too far back in the catalog to find it. But as quick as I would want to just say that as the answer here, Tridot Ambassador Donna Tosh also chimed in with a similar question and said, I have listened to the podcast about coming back, and while in theory we all know we need to take it easy, if you put a workout in front of us, a lot of us just can't help ourselves. So Kath and Donna both actually in their comments added some suggestions saying that maybe Tridot could add a pause button, to note that athletes are pausing for injury or illness, or maybe some form of way where you could tell Tridot how severe, of an injury or illness you have, and then maybe the training ramps back in. So of course, when our athletes make suggestions like this, we always pass ideas on to our performance scientists and our software developers. Some things are quantifiable, some things are not, but we always pass your ideas up. So for the question of easing back into training from illness, Coach Joe, what would you tell our athletes here?
Oh, this is so hard. And this one was probably aimed at me, or maybe Elizabeth, is that when it's on the schedule, it's super difficult to not want to get that session done. We are wired. Not like most of us triathletes are not type A personality at all. So it is very difficult to not want to make sure we've done all our sessions. And you know, one thing I find is that Tridot athletes are very obsessed with the TrainX scores and their completion for the week. So they struggle with that. Yeah, I often have to tell my athletes to stop freaking out over missed workouts. You know, when you're coming back from illness or an injury of sort, I know that we've had podcasts on this, but it really requires some daily self-evaluation. It's important to look at your resting heart rate. Is it still high? Are you still symptomatic? Can you take a deep breath? If you still have lots of congestion, well, you have to think about, will this training even be effective? Is it going to serve the purpose that it was intended to? Or is it going to be detrimental? Is it going to be a setback? Are you going to, you know, feel sicker? Or is this going to delay your recovery? I liked what Elizabeth was talking earlier about recovery is training. It's equal part training, equal part recovery, equal part nutrition, all of these things. So if you're not allowing yourself recovery time from illness, it's going to be detrimental overall to your performance in the long run. But there are a couple of things you can look at as far as, okay, I still want to do this session. But number one, let me reduce intensity. Most of the time with my athletes, I say, let's take it down to a zone one or two effort. Let's take it down and just monitor heart rate versus pushing zone four intervals. Number two, let's reduce duration. Let's knock down a short session by 15 minutes, or let's knock down a longer session by much more. In doing that, you know, you're still getting those endorphins from, you know, or that satisfaction of having the highlighted workout color-coded so that it is completed. We all know that we like to see that, you know, on our apps. The other thing I might do is, you know, when I'm talking to an athlete who's coming back from illness, is to give them other tasks. Let's distract them. Let's have them do strength work, or you know, a yoga practice, or substitute a full session of drilling when it comes to swimming instead of doing a swim, the prescribed swim workout. This way, they're very purposeful in what they're doing. They may be working on a different purpose for their session, but they are still, you know, they're still really, really working toward their goals. And the athlete is still progressing and still working on goals that they need to be working on. So I think it's important to take the time you need to recover, but in all reality, we're not wired that way. So maybe using some of these techniques will help you to substitute other sessions that will be just as effective.
Question eight comes from Becky Phillips. Shout out to Becky. She's one of our Waco area athletes. She was a volunteer on course at Ironman Waco when I raced, and I got to say hey to her while I was on the run course. She was working one of the water aid stations. So Becky, thanks for volunteering that day. She's one of our wonderful tri-daughters in the Waco area. And Becky is asking about nutrition. How do you train your gut for long activities when most of our workouts are only about an hour? She said, I'm good for an hour. I can eat just about anything or nothing for that length of time. It's activities over about 2.5 hours where things start to get dicey. And so, yeah, great point here from Becky. We talk about training your gut. We talk about practicing with the nutrition you're going to use on race day. But when your race is longer than an hour, not very many of our training sessions are longer than an hour. We don't get very many shots at practicing nutrition beyond an hour. Coach Elizabeth, I know you love going long. You frequently have long training sessions for your own race calendar. How do you coach your athletes in getting used to practicing your nutrition and figuring out what works for your gut, even if you don't have a ton of long sessions on the books?
Well, I think one of the first things here to point out is just a great thing that Becky has already identified when, I mean, as she put it, things get dicey. And she said, you know, I'm good for the hour. And anything over 2.5 is where, you know, she's starting to struggle and we're needing to look at a little bit more in detail what that nutrition looks like. Now, if you are training for a long course event right now, maybe your workouts are not much longer than an hour, but the long bike and the long run sessions will begin to exceed that 2.5 hours. And then, you know, every long workout is the perfect opportunity to work on your nutrition for that longer duration. And so, you know, right now you might still be in that development phase where, you know, you've got an intense hour on the bike, but as you get closer and closer to your event and the duration of those workouts starts to increase, then every single one of those is an opportunity to work on your nutrition. And that's one of the things that I work, I mean, very closely with my coached athletes on is, you know, every one of those long sessions, part of what I want them to report to me in their notes is not only how the session went and how they felt, but what was their nutritional intake going into the session? What was nutrition and hydration like ahead of time? What did they do afterwards? How did they feel? And so all of those things are very important to not only experiment with, but then also kind of catalog and write down so that you can go back to as part of your nutrition plan later. Now, if you are training for a shorter course event and you know that you're going to need some additional practice with nutrition, and maybe, you know, even extending some of those sessions so that you have the opportunity to practice for that specific duration, then reaching out to a coach or, you know, a nutritionist like Dr. Austin, that might be very helpful. Thinking from my perspective as a coach, I would want my athletes to have opportunities to practice their nutrition. And so that might mean extending the duration of a few workouts to allow for those opportunities to practice, depending on what they're leading up to, you know, how many practice opportunities we need. The main thing here is practice. And that might start to, you know, incorporate some of the nutrition even into those hour sessions. It might be a little more nutrition than you particularly need to get through that session, but starting to get used to taking in more nutrition for that hour, then extending it as you go into 90 minutes, 2 hours, 2.5, and building from there.
Question number 9, this comes from Annie Fox. She asked, how much time should someone spend in the aero position during workouts while on an indoor bike trainer workout? This is a great question. I actually used to do a majority of my time in aero indoors and doing some workouts indoors with my friends, Jeff Rains, John Mayfield, Elizabeth James. Over the years, I noticed that they did not spend as much time in aero as I did on indoor workouts. And we had some conversations and now I kind of split it up more 50-50, but great question here. Should we be in aero indoors? Should we not? Does it matter? Coach Jeff Rains, what are your thoughts here? What do you say to your athletes?
Oh man, it's a great question, Annie. And there's always that it depends aspect. I mean, each coach will have their own unique philosophy or response to this question. And largely it depends on your story. I mean, there's always a unique, it depends, because what if you just got a brand new bike, right? You can't get outdoors much and you have that big race coming up and you're doing that race on the bike. So obviously you're going to want to mix in maybe a little bit more than you normally would, but in a perfect season with plenty of time on a bike that you're pretty used to, let's say, we do largely sit different on a bike indoors than outdoors, and we need to be careful doing too much high-end quality in aero indoors. You know, that quality being kind of zone 3 and above. Anything zone 3 and above is considered quality, but largely that upper zone 4 and a lot of zone 5 in aero, you just need to be a little bit careful of. Indoors, we tend to sit further back on the seat. And what that does is it closes our hip angle off. As our bottom moves back on the seat, there's more surface area to rub against the seat, right? Because the seat largely gets wider as we move backwards. And so we've heard people say that, and this is so true, I can do an hour and a half indoor ride. And I have a little bit of chafing, a little bit of uncomfortable, maybe a saddle sore, right? We've all been there. But maybe a 3 or 4 hour ride outdoors, we don't have an issue at all because we tend to sit a little bit more forward on the seat outdoors. And so moving the bottom back on the seat, closing off that hip angle and doing a lot of high intensity can put a lot of strain on your lower back, right? And so really what we need to do is know the intent of the workout. If it's about threshold and then hitting watts and really getting that fitness out of it, then sit up. The point is to tax the body. Also know that, that let's say zone 5, it's more of an external response, right? Or maybe low cadence work, right? We're really actually wanting to have more of a physical external stressor, pushing a bigger gear, lower cadence, using bigger muscle groups, getting off the bike, doing squats, things like that. The point of that workout is to really get the legs working that high end. And so we don't want to be in aero doing that. Maybe your coach wants you to get out of the saddle the last 10 seconds because you might be doing that on a few of the hills in your big race. So just kind of know the intent of the workout. But I'll say this, if you're pushing zone 4 or 5, zone 4 or zone 5 plus, like in a race, especially half and full iron distances, then you're probably going up a huge hill. And in that scenario, you'll be sitting up, right? And so we tend to race in zone 3, you know, for the most part, for half and full iron. And so you don't need to be doing too much quality indoors and aero, but we do need to train that. Right. And so the balance of time in zone 2, or if that Thursday session, if you're in the race prep stamina phase, you can do that, you know, the majority of the zone 2 session. So use the balance of time finishing up a quality session. Do a lot of those zone 2 sessions in aero indoor if you're just super needing that extra time in aero. Just don't do too much of the quality inside of that.
Yeah, Jeff, I love the point you're making about just considering what your session is and what the intent of your session is, and even the intervals within that session. What is the intent of those intervals? More often than not, if there's zone 4 or 5 intervals, the point is to help you build power in your legs. You can do that sitting up just fine. Coach Jen Reinhart, just a few episodes ago, we had our 10 Next Level Tri Training Tips episode, and Coach Jen Reinhart gave us a great nugget about how she doesn't usually watch things on TV. She doesn't usually listen to anything distracting because she likes focusing on something within her intervals. And so maybe that's something for you is certain intervals you focus on holding aero. I mean, for me, if Tri-Dot puts me in zone 3 indoors on a trainer, I try to be an aero for those zone 3 sessions, because more often than not, when I'm racing outside, I'm usually in zone 3 at those race paces. And so I try to do zone 3 in aero. Maybe there's certain days where you're going to be just spinning easy in zone 2 for an hour because it's an easy ride. And maybe sometimes you let that be upright. Maybe sometimes you take that 60 minutes and see how much of that you can hold aero. But yeah, to your point, Jeff, to Coach Jen's point a few weeks back, you know, be intentional with what you're doing in your intervals. And sometimes that intentionality can be practicing aero, and sometimes it can be sitting up and really pumping the legs in an upright position. Our last kind of big question here that I want to talk on, and then I have some quick hitting short ones to end with. This is Alexander Volkov. He asked this: how does the Tri-Dot platform consider the VLA max development, whether that decreases or increases within an athlete? Is it important at all for an athlete to know our VLA max? Coach John Mayfield, what does Tri-Dot do with VLA max? And I admittedly, if you're listening to this and you're like, what the heck is VLA max? Alexander asked this and I had to Google VLA max. I've heard of VO2 max. I've heard of blood glucose. There's several metrics I'm familiar with. I hadn't heard or read anybody talk about VLA max before. So I did a little reading myself just at when Alexander asked this question. Coach John Mayfield, talk to us about this.
Yeah. So kind of, as you mentioned, it kind of is a hot new metric. It's been around for a couple of years. It's gained popularity really in the last year or two, and it considers the lactate in the muscle. But it is one of those that is still very difficult to consistently and accurately measure. So it requires a lot of hands-on and trial and error. So it's really geared for oftentimes, I'd say the ones that are most successful in implementing these type of metrics are the elite athletes that really all they do is train. They work with a staff of professionals that have access to lab type equipment and can test on a regular basis. Because like I said, a lot of this is trial and error. So what they're doing is they're testing these metrics. They're doing what they hypothesize as will be productive training, and then they're testing again to see what the impact is. So it's kind of cumbersome or quite cumbersome, and really is the intent of this is to really kind of squeak out those last few drops of performance. So this is not something that really your average triathlete is really going to benefit from investing the time and resources into tracking and implementing into their training. This is for those that, you know, kind of like we talk about Olympic level swimmers, they're chasing hundredths of a second.
Gotcha.
So this would be something that kind of is equivalent to that. This is a very high level elite athlete that really is already mastering training as a rule. you know, they have those fundamentals of training. They have all those things down, and they're looking for what is that last thing that is going to give them the edge. So a lot of times, like this, these things come at a high cost and have a low return. For those high end professional elite athletes, that's fine. It's worth it. You know, they're willing to do what is necessary to get every drop of performance out of their potential. But for the vast majority of athletes, you know, there's a lot more consistency. There's a lot better increase in execution of training that really should be the focus. Instead of getting hung up on some of these metrics that come into popularity and at different times, you know, I would say continue to focus on high level of doing the right training right, as we say. You know, there are opportunities out there, but you know, there's a lot of other things you can test for in the lab that can really provide some neat insights into your body. But again, they provide a snapshot as to happening what is happening in that exact moment. And as training athletes, our bodies are constantly changing. So for this information to be pertinent and relevant, it needs to be accurately and consistently measured on an ongoing basis, which again is inconvenient, it's expensive. And then as far as integration in with TriDot is based on big data. So we need a very large data set of normalized data, which that simply does not exist here yet. So, you know, things like heart rate and power and all the metrics that we track, we have tens of millions of training files from tens of thousands of athletes that allow the TriDot analytics to draw meaningful conclusions. Right now these metrics like this just they aren't there. They don't kind of pass the snuff test so far as that goes, but we'll see where that goes.
Great set, everyone. Let's cool down.
Well, hello there, everyone. I'm Vanessa, your average triathlete with elite level enthusiasm. I know you've all been anxiously awaiting the coach cooldown tip, so let's get to it with TriDot coach Ken Prasuti. By day, Ken transforms digital products as an agile product coach at a large U.S. bank. And by night, he transforms athletes into triathlon champions. He has coached multiple Ironman world champion qualifiers. He has taken Olympic age groupers all the way to the podium and has coached junior world elite triathletes as well. His coaching background also includes top high school runners in the state of Pennsylvania. He currently loves working with athletes at all levels, and as a master chi running instructor, he really specializes in helping athletes with their run form and staying injury-free. Ken was born and raised in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, and lives there with his wife and 10-year-old son. Welcome to the cool down, Ken.
Thank you so much for having me. It's awesome to be here.
All right, so I have a quick question for you before we get to the tip. I noticed that you started in this sport 10 years before you found TriDot. What made you try out this platform and then soon become a TriDot coach?
Yeah, great question. I think that this was probably back in 2019 when I was getting ready for my second run at Ironman Louisville. And I don't even know how it showed up on my feed, but John Mayfield was doing a race preview, and I thought, wow, this looks really cool. Let me check it out. And at the time, I also had several athletes that I was coaching that were doing Louisville with me too. So I referred them, or I said, hey, check this out with me. Let's get on this and hear what they have to say. And so we went through and we listened to it, and being somewhat of a tech guy myself by day, I was like, this looks really cool. I could see some potential here. And so I signed up for a trial, and I think the rest is kind of history. I can remember even vividly at the race. I signed up for the trial was probably after the race itself. So when on race day, I'm running down the streets of Louisville and the TriDot tent is up, and I see a whole bunch of people cheering them on. I thought, wait, that's the people that were on that race preview I listened to. I got home and I said, it's the off season, but let me see what this is all about. And right as I had signed up, I heard Andrew on a podcast talking about, hey, if you're a coach and you're interested in what we do, reach out. Yeah. And so, you know, I think as coaches, we like to think that we've got the secret sauce, and we all have this, like, you know, this specialized thing that we do. And I think that's true. I think we all have our own secret sauce that we bring, but it's not so much just in the creation of the plant, right? And I quickly saw the benefits that, okay, I've got some artificial intelligence helping me along the way. This can really lead to some great results for my athletes. And by the way, it has, right?
Awesome. That's so cool. Well, what triathlon tip do you have for us today?
Yeah, so you had mentioned that I am a master chi running instructor. And for anybody that's not familiar with that, that's okay. It's just, it's a way of approaching running that helps runners move more naturally, really the way our bodies were designed to run. And so the number one thing when I'm working with triathletes that I notice is almost all of us, and I was certainly guilty of this when I ran my first Ironman, we overstride like crazy. So my tip would be, if you find yourself overstriding, or maybe you don't even know, right?
Yeah.
Try to get more in tune with your body. So as you're taking those strides, where is your foot landing? Is it landing out ahead of your knee? Is it landing below your knee? Or you find that it's landing behind your center of gravity? Most of us are going to find we're striking way ahead of the knee, right? I would say be aware of that and see if you can slow yourself down a little bit and try to get that foot to land closer to underneath your knee versus ahead of the knee. It's going to reduce the shock that comes into the body. And there are a whole bunch of other steps that you can take to work on posture and all of those things. But I think the first step and the first tip is really be aware of where that foot is striking, right? And we can get into specific, like, are you heel striking? Are you forefoot striking? I don't even care about any of that just yet.
Right.
Just be aware of where that foot is coming down and try to keep as close to landing below the knee as you can.
Okay. Okay. And for those of us that might not be as in tune with our bodies and we think that we're actually, you know, striking in the right place, how would we possibly know if we're thinking that we're doing the right thing, but maybe we're not? How would we know that we're doing it incorrectly?
Yeah, that's a great question as well. So I think two things, right? One, just have a friend take some videotape of you and take a look, right? I say videotape, but we don't put video tapes anymore. So get some video and just take a quick look. But the other thing that you could do, and this is what I really like to do and have my athletes try, is I call it the knee bending drill. So if you just stand in place, and we talk about, you know, certainly jog in place, right? I think most people know what I mean when I say jog in place. And when you jog in place, you're simply lifting up your ankles behind you, right? You're keeping your knees low and your feet are always landing right below them. Mm-hmm. So just do a little bit of jogging in place. See if you can feel those knees, what that feels like when your feet land right below those knees by staying in place. And then when you're ready, you can allow yourself to move forward just by letting your shoulders and your core fall forward just a little bit and you'll start to move and those feet will still fall right below those knees.
Aha. That sounds like I'm just imagining myself picking up my knees right now. And I'm like, oh, I must be an overstrider because when I pick my knees up, there's a lot more, you know, bending of the knee. And when I run, the angle between my knee and my lower leg is much greater. I know it is. So I'm going to have to.
Yeah. And you always want to keep those knees a little bit soft, never lock them out, but just be mindful of where the foot is landing and try to keep it right below.
Yeah. Cool. That's an awesome tip. Thank you so much for sharing that with us today and happy running to everyone out there.
Thanks for joining us. Make sure to subscribe and share the TriDot podcast with your triathlon crew. For more great Tri content and community, connect with us on Facebook, YouTube, and Instagram. Ready to optimize your training? Head to TriDot.com and start your free trial today. TriDot, the obvious and automatic choice for triathlon training.